From WXXI News, this is Connections, broadcasting from WEOS in Geneva. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in your backyard. Anytime you see, swat, or move away from a bee. Maybe not the best idea to swat them, but here's something I learned after reading the work of farmer and writer Matt Kelly. Not all bees sting. And there's even a bee that's so gentle, it's referred to by some people as the tickle bee. There are thousands of varieties of bees, bees of different colors, shapes, sizes. Most are solitary, some are social. Some live in the ground, others live in hollows. And here's something else I didn't know. There aren't any bees that make honey. So this hour, it's Bees 101. And Matt Kelly is joining me at WEOS in Geneva, as I mentioned, to answer your questions. Questions like, are bees in trouble? What can we do for bees in our backyard? And how can bees help our environment? Also, is this bee going to sting me? Matt Kelly, welcome to WEOS. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can join this conversation. Ask Matt your questions about bees by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. So Matt, my first question for you, how do you get into bees? What brought you to bee research?
Fortuitously. So I had been writing about agriculture for quite some time, particularly locally. Some of the first pieces I did nationally were for a publication called New Food Economy, and I happened to do a piece on the rusty patch bumblebee, which is the first bumblebee to be listed as an endangered species. Out of all the species on the list, bees had never made it until 2016-17. And the rusty patch was the first one. That kind of got me into it. But kind of the interesting part of that was I've always kind of been interested in these hidden worlds, soil science, seed science, all these kind of things that we kind of take for granted. But there's really this deeper, more interesting world that exists when you start looking. And bees certainly fall into that category.
And there are a lot of, from your writing, I've learned, there are a lot of misconceptions about bees. And I was surprised to see that there are about 4,000 different varieties.
Yeah. So what you'll get out of this conversation is a lot of, yeah, kind of. So mainly because, so the number of species in North America is somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000. And that's because new species are being discovered. Species are being reclassified. There was just a case in Toronto, which is kind of interesting. I believe it was at York University. A grad student there was going through the cases where they have all their bees displayed. And he suddenly said, there are 15 species in here that haven't been identified. So just within this collected case, he was able to identify 15 new species, which brings the total up a bit.
You were showing me a book that you brought into the studio, and on the cover of that book, many different bees, lots of different sizes. You said some can be as big as your thumb, others are, what was the smallest size you mentioned?
They can sit right on the inside of your pinky nail. So it's, and that's one of the most fascinating parts about bees, is I think typically when you say bee, people think honeybee, hive, colony, that kind of aspect. But out of the 4,000 roughly species in North America, honeybees are only one. And they are not native, which doesn't make them good or bad. They just were brought over by the colonists when they came over 1400s, 1500s, 1600s. Most bees in the United States, as you said in the intro, are solitary. They don't live in colonies. They live in the ground. So they're solitary. They're a single female that will mate. They'll dig a burrow into the ground. They'll lay a brood of about eight larvae. And then they patch up their hole and they die. And so they never meet their offspring. They're only around for 4 to 6 weeks, maybe a couple months at most. And then the next season, the brood come out. They sort of automatically know what to do. And they just pick up and the cycle repeats itself.
I'm starting to think that every childhood narrative or story I've read about bees has been false, because you think about stories that you hear or things you see on television. Doesn't seem to be the case. A lot of misconceptions and misunderstanding about bees and how they socialize, it seems.
So what I find really interesting is inevitably when you talk about bees, somebody's going to reference colony collapse disorder.
Yes.
Which has impacted honeybees. And the interesting thing about colony collapse disorder is it was a real wake-up call for both society as a whole, but certainly for researchers, farmers, people that have these more intimate relationships with bees. So colony collapse disorder kind of gets officially identified in 2007. And people start asking, like, if we're going to lose all the honeybees, maybe all of these wild pollinators that we know that are out there could pick up the slack. And then all of a sudden, the people that were saying that was like, we don't know anything about those wild pollinators. We don't even know if that's possible. So around that time, one of the researchers that I've talked to in, you know, collecting information and writing about this topic had this great statement. He said it was their come to Jesus moment, where they were like, oh, we need to figure out more. Because up until that point, most bee science was focused on honeybees. And past that, most interest in bees was just about collecting them. How many different green bees do I have? How many different big bees do I have? Where did I find them? You know, it was more of a trophy thing, right? Which has been valuable, and we can talk about that at some point, because having these deep collections of bees going back to the 1800s really is a trove of information. But what happened around colony collapse disorder is that was the point when many researchers started looking at native pollinators, understanding their biology, understanding their relationships with flowers, understanding their place in the world. And so, you know, I don't want to be too hard on the narratives that we've had about bees as children and the narratives we still have, because truly understanding, you know, the other 3,999 bees that exist in North America is only a 10-year-old field. People have only been doing it for the past decade. So we're still, it's really exciting because we're still at this point where we're learning so much and everything is new. And it's really astounding.
Do you feel like as a researcher and as you're writing, you're at the beginning stages of maybe this explosion of bee research? What does that feel like? What do you anticipate in terms of the direction we'll go in what we learn and how we can change our ecosystems and our environment and our choices that we make in urban planning based on what we're learning about bees?
I think, like a lot of things, it has the potential to really open our eyes to new ways of doing things. A good example of this, there's several examples of this, but one good example comes out of one of the bee labs at Cornell, the Danforth lab. They're doing some great stuff specifically on native pollinators. And so within New York, the apple industry is huge, right? And so many apple farmers would have historically and traditionally brought in hives of bees. You just truck them in, you bring in your honeybees, they pollinate, and then they ship out to the season for somewhere else. What the Danforth lab is finding is that a lot of these native pollinators, particularly a type of bee called mining bees, are actually more effective pollinators in the orchards than a honeybee is. And that's not to badmouth a honeybee, because honeybees are incredible creatures that have their place in this world. But the mining bees, and this was a really cool experiment, because what they did is they collected all the species that they found in an apple orchard, and they found something like 40 species. So honeybees were only one. And then the most populous species was this mining bee. Okay, so it's the most common species. And then they found that it had the most hairs on its body. And then they found that it was actually carrying the most pollen within those hairs. I mean, they actually counted individual pollens within the bee hairs. So using this kind of real, you know, drilling down into that hidden world, really looking at it and saying, hey, apple orchards, what really is probably going to increase your pollination, the pollination effectiveness and fruit set in your orchards, is creating native habitat. Again, not to badmouth the honeybees, but let's really start building that native habitat, because that's really what's going to keep bees around that do the work we need them to do.
And there's a lot of important work happening in that respect in Toronto. We'll talk about that during this hour. I know you're pretty impressed with what's going on there. I want to hear your thoughts about what's going on locally. But we have some questions coming in about the differences between different kinds of bees, the differences between bees and wasps. Mm-hmm. So Mike in Brighton has some thoughts on the difference between bees and wasps. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I like the point that your guest made that Apis mellifera, which is the European honeybee, is not native to the U.S. And I was formerly in the pest control industry, and a lot of people weren't aware of that. But the majority of calls I would get, people would call, oh, I got bees. I have ground bees. I have bees going into a crack in the side of my wall. And I would say probably 98% of them were actually yellow jackets, which are wasps and nothing. They look very similar to bees, but they have nothing to do with them. They're actually predators, and they're a completely different species. But people get easily confused by that. And I would have customers say, oh, you have to kill the bees. I'm like, well, man, they're actually wasps. And they do have a beneficial aspect because they are predators. They do eat pests for, you know, agricultural pests and things like that. But you don't want a nest of yellow jackets underneath your front porch where people are coming and going from your home and things like that. So I thought it was just an important distinction that people know that, you know, yellow jackets are not bees. They're a totally separate species.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for sharing that. Matt, I see you nodding your head.
Okay.
Important distinction to make.
No, I think it's a super important distinction to make. So the fun part of this is going back in history, bees are a type. So if you look at that whole big, you know, like chart of animal life that we had to study in biology and then never remembered until we started doing other stuff, right? Bees actually are a type of wasp. 125 million years ago, all we had were wasps. We can see that in the fossil record. Then about 100 million years ago, we get this fossil record of bees, and we can tell because of the hairs on the legs and all these sorts of features, physical features that make them look like bees. And so the theory goes that at some point along this sequence, one of these wasps, 125 million years ago, who were hunting other insects, they started capturing insects and eating insects that were on flowers. And so they got a taste for pollen. And eventually at some point, a segment of this wasp population switched to eating pollen. Because having talked to folks that have looked at this, if you break down the nutrient content of pollen in flowers and the nutrient content of an insect, it's basically the same thing. So it's very easy to see how an insect could switch from one for the other. So our modern bees, they are not wasps. They are, the joke is they're a vegan wasp. That's basically what the joke is. So
I am nerding out about this conversation. This is great.
Well, and so for folks at home, I think what's really important, there are some very easy ways to identify the difference between bees and wasps. And one of them is basic behavior. If it's on a flower and it looks really busy and it looks like it's hunting, you know, really searching for stuff, it's a bee. The majority of wasps, the majority of hornets are not looking for pollen. If they're on a flower, they're just resting and then they lift off.
But if you're seeing a nest or if you're seeing something up in near your gutter,
yeah,
on the roof.
Any of those paper type of nests and the sort of the like multi-celled nests that sit under your eaves, that's going to be a hornet or a wasp.
And what's the best way to handle that if you find one of those hanging out in your yard?
Call our caller. Sounds like he can
Yeah, call Mike. He can help you out. That's important, though, because, and it goes back to what you were saying about socialization. So are bees not living in what would you call those paper type nests? Yeah. Are they not living there because they are solitary? But there are some bees that live in condo type situations, right? So what's the difference between those two things?
So those nests that you see constructed are wasp constructions. Honeybees, honeybees we typically find in colonies at this point. Historically, wild honeybee populations would be in a tree log. They'd actually find a cavity. And so bumblebees, which live in colonies, do the same things. They find a cavity to live in. We've actually had them on the farm living in cinder blocks. And I think they just tried to make a home there, and they were like, no, we can't really do that. And then they all moved on. So they look for cavities. Carpenter bees don't live in colonies per se, but they will find cavities and they lay their brood in there. They'll chew at wood to create those holes too. But again, most bees, like mining bees and sweat bees and a whole bunch of other types of bees, will burrow these little tunnels down into the ground. And they create, like I said, they just create this little burrow down there. Some are twig nesters, so a lot of stems. So if you kind of picture best picture is like a sunflower field, right? End of the season, all the stalks fall down. You have all these stalks laying around. Bees might find a home in those hollow stalks. They might chew a hole in them. What is interesting is there are some semi-social bees, and the ones that I know about typically exist in the southwest of the United States. And one of the bee types is called Diadasia. It doesn't have a common name. It's just got the fancy science name. And it will create not a colony, but the best description is like a condo. So there's a single entrance, and all these different females go through the same entrance, but they each build their own little burrow off of this common entrance. And so it becomes more like an apartment complex. They're not taking care of each other's nests or each other's broods. They're not getting food for each other. They're just sharing a communal living space. And so that's a kind of a semi-social species. I don't know of any out here in New York, but out west, you get those.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the the point you make in your writing about there aren't any bees that make honey.
Well, the honeybee does, but that's the only bee.
Oh, right. So outside of that variety.
Right. I think bumblebees might make a little, but it's not something that would ever be commercially viable. We'd never know about it. It's not like the bear is going to go to the bumblebee nest. It's going to go to the honeybee nest.
But speaking of the bumblebee, I was talking to my colleague Beth Adams this morning, and she said the bumblebee is endangered. Is that true?
This is one of those yes, kind of.
One very yes, kind of. Yeah. Okay.
So rusty-patched bumblebee was a bumblebee, a single species out of the 49 species that exist in the United States, at North America, that was recently listed as an endangered species. And that's because, to use New York as an example, it used to have a range in New York. Starting in, when researchers looked at this, from the 1990s up through the mid-2000s, the population of rusty-patched bumblebees in the Northeast disappeared by upwards of 90%. So there was a very severe and sudden drop-off. And there are a whole bunch of thoughts about why that might have happened.
What are some of those reasons, do you think?
Kind of the typical culprits. It would be use of insecticides. It would be habitat destruction or fragmentation and diseases, either kind of native inherent diseases or stuff that gets passed around because of how we move colonies throughout the United States. So that is one bee that's clearly endangered. And that actually grew out of a study from these researchers that looked at 20 different types of species. And so what you find is that there are four species in the United States that are really hard hit, that have seen declining numbers. Many other populations of bumblebees are stable. They haven't changed from one measurement to the next. And then there are others that have actually grown. I think Bombus impatiens, which is the common eastern honeybee, is doing quite well, hence the name common. So there is a range, and that's why it's difficult to say. That's why it's really important to be clear that when we ask about whether bees are in trouble, whether bee populations are declining, it's kind of like it's like if someone came up and said, are birds declining?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of them.
Right.
And it just kind of depends on context. It depends on which species. It depends on the environment, all those sorts of things.
Listeners, you are hearing Bees 101 with farmer and writer Matt Kelly, who's joining me at WEOS in Geneva. And you can call with your questions about bees, any concerns, any comments you might have. Now is your chance to talk to an expert. 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's go back to the question about stinging.
Mm-hmm.
Because not all bees sting, I
that
learned after reading your writing. And the phrase, the tickle bee, made me laugh, if nothing else. But there are some bees that are very gentle, you were writing. That's
right. So, yeah. So, again, because most people think of the honeybee, honeybees sting. They have a very distinct stinger. It's a harpoon-like stinger. It's very serrated. So what you get with a honeybee is that when they sting, their barbs catch on the inside of your skin. It pulls out the venom sac, and they only get one shot at it, and that's pretty much it. Bumblebees, on the other hand, have a smooth sting. And I'm sorry, this is where my friends in science will correct me if I don't correct myself, is it's a sting, not a stinger. So it's both noun and verb. So the bumblebee sting is smooth, and they can take multiple shots with it. Again, they also have a venom sac. But outside of the roughly 50 bumblebees that exist and the one species of honeybee we have here, no other bees have the potential to actually sting a human. Now, to clarify that is, every female bee will have a sting, because the sting is a vestigial ovipositor. It's how they used to lay their eggs. The eggs now come out of a little different opening near the sting. So every female will have a sting. Whether it's big enough to break human skin is something that's completely different. So
should we be as afraid of bees as most people typically might be? You know, if you see a bee, I have a friend, we were walking the other day, he saw a bee and he was running away.
No one should ever do that.
It's hard for most people to know exactly what kind of a bee they're looking at. You've brought a book in here and there are so many different kinds. I would not know. I would just say there's a bee.
Right.
So how do you know? What's the best way to approach this?
Well, I would say by and large, no, we should not be as afraid of bees as we have. And that is probably the one spot where I would fault the common narrative on this is, how many of us grew up with cartoons with, somebody runs away from a bee. There's very little reason to do that. And actually there are plenty of reasons to welcome them into our environments. Who should be afraid of bees? Well, when it comes to bee stings, what statistics show us is there's a very low chance that any individual is going to develop a severe allergic reaction because you, again, and this is just statistics, so the human element's a little different, right? Statistics will tell us that you basically have to get stung a bunch of times over the span of your life to kind of have your immune system get a little haywire with it. It depends on the type of bee that might sting you. There's a question of whether if you get stung by bumblebees and then you get stung by honeybees, is that the same sort of allergic reaction? And you have to kind of have a genetic predisposition to it. So
I don't mean to minimize the fear that people who are allergic to bees have. So I apologize if I did that. But so say you don't have an allergy. There's a bee near you. You're worried about it possibly stinging you. You're not sure what type of bee it might be.
Right.
What's the best way to just move aside? Of course, don't swat it. You know, we're seeing a lot of people with newspapers. Sometimes there's a person in my neighborhood who does that. Not the right approach.
I mean, I guess I would have to say do what you feel is comfortable, right? Like I certainly, like you said, I don't want to minimize anybody's concern about bees because I'm not allergic to bees. And if I ever were, I would react very differently. My thoughts on that, I mean, when I'm around bees, I feel very comfortable around bees. I mean, I pick up and I handle individual bees when I'm looking at them. But that being said, I'm also aware that bumblebees, the big furry bees, and honeybees, which everybody recognizes, are the ones that are going to sting me. So if you have any concerns, recognize the type of bee. If you're afraid about being stung, don't go near a honeybee colony. You know, that would kind of be the basic premise. As for all the other bees, I say make space for them. I say make a home for them. I say bring them into your garden and into your yard as much as you can.
And in the second half of this conversation, we'll talk about the benefits bees can have on our environment, what they can do for our food systems, how we can help them. But first up, we've got a call, and I think this is a question about yellow jackets. This is Kathy in Rochester. Go ahead, Kathy. Kathy, are you there?
Well, hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. The question is a yellow jacket an actual bee? And I've had trouble with them in the past. Do they come back to the same nest from year to year? And are they ornery at this time of year? I know they are in late summer.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Go ahead, Matt.
Kathy, the best answer I can give you is they are not a bee. And past that, I don't know much of anything about yellow jackets.
We might have to call Mike back.
We might have to call Mike back. That's right.
So
okay.
Not a bee, Kathy.
All right, thank you.
Sure, thanks
All right,
for calling.
Thanks. Okay.
A question just came in about pesticides and the possible impact they may have had on colony collapse. Matt, I know we talked about that briefly, but the role of pesticides, of course, very big right now. A lot of conversations about how to minimize the use of pesticides in our yards, but does that have a direct relation to colony collapse?
I can't say for sure because the issue with colony collapse is it's still very much a mystery. Nobody was kind of at ground zero on it, and as with many things with bee research, you know, to look at how any particular act or event has an impact on a bee population, you really kind of have to have a before picture and then an after picture. And in many cases, we only have the after picture. So we kind of have to guess what that, or do the best we can to get a sense of that before picture. Insecticides, and I think it's important to clarify, pesticides is a very broad category. There's herbicides, there's insecticides. And so insecticides are the category of pesticide that is most harmful. But really what we're talking about is neonicotinoids, which is this class of insecticides. It's effectively a nerve agent, right? So the chemicals will bind to the neurons in the bee's nervous system, cause them to get super agitated, and that's where it causes paralysis and death. Now, it's not used, that class of insecticides is not used specifically for bees. We're talking about incidental contact. And that's really the concern. They're very, you know, there's nobody that I know of using neonics to specifically for bees, it's that incidental contact. So within our own yards, within our own backyards, that is probably one of the biggest, most important steps any of us can take to protect and to nurture and to facilitate bee populations where we are. Hands down, I'm just thinking through all the folks I've talked with in the research community, and hands down, they will all say if there's one thing that people can do, it's that. And folks should, you know, it's really important to be careful because we think of insecticides and neonics as being a spray. And neonics are used as a seed coating. They're saturated into the soil. So many times when you will go to a big box garden store, Many of their plants may have been treated in some way, shape, or form with this insecticide. And the problem is it doesn't just stay in that plant. It's a systemic insecticide, and it will leach into the soil, it will leach into the water. Again, there's research out of Cornell that shows that bees that were living in orchards, collecting pollen in orchards, that had never used neonics, had neonics in their pollen and their bee bread. So this stuff can spread. And so it's very important to understand all the ways that this can get into your system.
What do you look for on, is that listed on packaging? If you're to buy a plant, maybe at Home Depot or someplace, are you looking for those words, or is
that is
not
a great question that I don't know the answer to. I grow all my own stuff. Like you know, I grow everything from seeds. I know where I get my seeds from. That would be a great question to ask the people at the store, and I'm not certain that they could answer it, because you're really talking about, I mean, it's like the food system, right? It's like there are so many steps between point of origin and where I buy it. So, I think if you were to go to a garden store, they would be more likely to answer that question, because they just specialize in plants and they know where they're getting their stuff from. I think they'd have a better chance of being able to direct you, point you in the right direction. Going to a store that kind of just is a general store and also have plants, my suspicion is they will be less likely to tell you, and it might be more likely that they have been treated plants, only because typically people buy plants and they want them to look good, or otherwise they don't feel like they've gotten their money's worth, so...
Mm-hmm. Okay, up next on the lines, up next on the phones, Lisa in Rochester. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, my question is for Matt. Are you guys there? You hear
me? Yep, go ahead. We can hear you.
Okay. Oh, okay. So about a month ago, I heard this unbelievably loud buzzing, and it was on my kitchen screen, in between the screen and the window, was something that looked, I'm not kidding, like a 2-inch hornet. It was the hugest thing I've ever seen, and I can't believe I'm actually talking to you because I'm not over it yet. And I'm wondering if you can help me figure out what the hell that was. It was huge.
I would love to help you figure out what that was. It's hard to do without actually seeing the actual insect. And maybe I can give you some guidance here and you can kind of think through it, although I don't want to put you back in that scary space if that's where we're going to take you here.
No, okay.
So, I mean, if you were to do a side-by-side comparison between a bee and a wasp, right? Bees typically have a thicker body. Have a thicker body, and wasps typically have a very thin profile. They typically have a really thin waist between their thorax and their abdomen, their midsection and their behind. Bees typically are very furry because they're all about collecting the pollen. Wasps are not. They're naked and shiny. Bees will have a lot of hair on their legs, and wasps will have very thin legs. They'll be very splayed out, and you'll see like these little spines on them because they're predators. They're trying to catch things. I don't know if that helps you at all in terms of thinking back on that, about what it might be.
Well, I can tell you it was not hairy.
Okay.
And it had yellow on it. And it didn't have that separated, I know what you mean by that, where it looks like it's kind of hanging by a string type thing.
Yeah, it can be.
It looked like it wasn't like that. It was a super humongous. I actually did take a picture. I wish I could, and I would send it to you if you wanted to see it.
Yeah, feel free. Send it to connections@wxxi.org. We'll take a look at it during the break.
Okay, I'll send it. I will. But see, the thing is, it's on the screen, and you can't really tell how huge it is. But if you, open it up and really look at it, I'm telling you, it was, I can't believe how big it was. I will send it to, okay, connections@wxxi. I'll send it during the break.
Okay, thanks, Lisa.
Okay, thank you.
And listeners, your questions and feedback from Matt coming in, pouring in, I should say, swarming in, if we want to use our bee analogies. So we'll get to those right after the break. We're going to take that short break, and when we come back, we'll also talk about city pollination. That's a question someone on the line has, and what's going on in Toronto, some efforts there about how to create a symbiotic relationship between humans and bees, how we can improve our own environment with their help, how we can help them. Matt's an expert in all of that. He's a farmer and a writer. And Matt, where can people find your work?
They can find my work at thebeereport.com.
Thebeereport.com. So short break, more connections next.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a question we all have to consider in our own way. What do we do about art and artists when the artists misbehave, when the artists offend us, or when the artists step over the line when it comes to sexual harassment, whether it's comedy entertainment, other fields. When do we stop consuming their art, and when do we give them a pass? That's Monday.
You are listening to Connections. We're broadcasting at WEOS in Geneva today. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson, and we're talking with Matt Kelly. He's a farmer and a writer and an expert in bees. He's answering your questions and some concerns about bees, and maybe some concerns we shouldn't have about bees. I'll go to an email next. This comes from Karen. She says, "It seems every time we sit outside on the deck, bees soon appear. There's no food, no drinks on the deck. Due to such, we're spending very little time out on our deck. Any ideas on how to navigate a quote-unquote bee-free zone?"
Again, it would be hard to say because I would want to be certain that those are actually bees. Typically, bees don't want to hang around people. So here's from a research perspective, when you go out in the field and you try to find bees, they typically move away from you. So if they're moving close to you, flies are another insect that can mimic bee appearances. And so it's very important to be able to tell the distinction between those. Again, thinking about bees as having a really thick body or a thick connection between their midsection and their rear end, flies are very thick. Bees will typically have four wings that they'll fold up behind them when they land, that right over their body. Flies will have two wings that kind of stick out to the side. And the really telling factor that you can look at for flies and bees is bees have very long antennae, and their eyes typically sit on the side of their head. Flies have almost no antennae, and their eyes are just these big bulbous creature-like things that almost touch in the front. So that's a very easy way to tell the difference. And again, bees are very purposeful. Like, they're looking for pollen and honey, because what you have to remember is, again, most of the bees that we're gonna run into, whether you realize it or not, they're only around for 4 to 6 weeks. They're trying to get enough food to fill up for their brood to survive on until the next season, and a little bit extra for themselves. They don't have time to mess around.
4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, roughly. I mean, we're talking a fairly short season. It could be 2 months, but yeah, very short lifespan. So honeybees and bumblebees can be the exception to that. And just since we're talking about it, most bees are, to make the gardening analogy, are annuals. There's a brood, you know, a female comes out, she lays her brood, then she dies, never going to meet her offspring. The next brood will come out the next season, repeat the process, on and on and on. Whereas honeybees have a perpetual colony. Offspring meet queen, and so on and so on and so forth. But for most bees that you're going to run into, they don't have time to mess around. So my suspicion would be is if they're just coming and hanging out on your deck when there's no flowers, there's no sugar water, you know, like there's no reason for them to be there, it might be a fly, be my guess.
You mentioned a queen bee. I was having a conversation with a friend recently, and we were trying to figure out, what does a queen bee actually do? What is the queen bee's role?
To lay eggs. To lay eggs, yeah. That's her role. To perpetuate the colony.
Okay, so she's not going out and...
No. No.
Pollinating flowers.
So, no. And again, it depends on the species
right,
we're talking
honeybee.
About.
Right, honeybee. Yes. Right. Sorry. Right. I need to be more specific. Thank you.
Well, no. So just to break it down into three simple categories. So honeybees, the queen is basically sitting there and perpetuating the species. She's got all her drones doing, or I don't want to say the word drone because that's going to get me in trouble with somebody. She's got many other types of bees in the hive doing the work for her. Bumblebees, the queen will emerge. We'll be looking around for food. We'll eventually, do incidental pollination and eventually find a place to set her nest and then kind of set that in motion. But all of those solitary bees, those females are their own queen and worker. I mean, they're doing everything. They're the single mom of the bee world, right? Mm. They're getting everything done, and they're doing it full bore and getting it done as quickly as they can. Those are the bees that actually, again, are most effective at pollinating, or at least that's what we're finding with many species, because honeybees, when they pollinate, they're like on a highway between certain flowers. Like, honeybees are regimented. They're like, I know flower A blossoms at noon, I know flower B is going to blossom at 1, and I know flower C is going to blossom at 3. And they're on a mission, and they're like, and they're just going. Native bee, or the little solitary bees are, they're just sort of opportunistic. What flowers around me? I'm just bopping around. I got to find the things that are going on around me. I got to just get this and grab this. And they're not as drilled into trying to collect pollen. They're just bumping into stuff, and they're grabbing stuff, and it sticks to their body. And that's how they end up doing really effective pollination. And then they bring it all back, and then they go out and they do it again. So Yeah.
Okay. I'm learning so much. And I know, listeners, you are too. You're calling in with great questions. Up next on the phone is Rima in Rochester. Go ahead, Rima.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
As you said, well, for a brief while in my life, I was a beekeeper, so I know a little something about bees, but not a whole lot about farming. And I know the bees were imported from Europe, and so were most of the things we eat. And so I'm wondering if the decline of the honeybee population will have a drastic effect on our food supply.
All right. Great question, Rima. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question, and that would be a whole show unto itself. But that was really the concern coming out of colony collapse disorder, is this idea is that we had this really heavy dependence on honeybees, and it's wondering whether or not other bees could pick up the slack. And that's really the question we're struggling with right now, in large part, is that how much do these other types of bees actually engage with the farming systems we have? And we're finding out quite a bit. You know, the apple orchards in New York are a great example.
Well, I heard you talk about the apple orchards. That was interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's fascinating work.
Right?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The ones in the apple orchards, I forgot what you call them, but they're native to America.
Many of them are.
Right?
Many of them are, yes. I couldn't attest to all of them, but many of them are.
Well, thanks, Rima. You raise a great point, both about food supply and colony collapse. Matt, what's the worst case scenario for the food supply related to colony collapse?
Wow, that's,
I know, I'm putting you on the spot. Worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario. Worst case scenario is that. So I'm going to back up for a second here. We're not going to lose every single bee at once. Right. So that's often when we talk about the impact on the farm system, there's this just kind of this inherent assumption that, like, oh, we're going to have bees and then the next day we're not. What's going to happen? So that's never going to happen. We're going to see a trickling off effect, which is what colony collapse disorder kind of got us into. What we would potentially find if we continued to lose bee species is we might find the loss of particular types of food. Right. Like, we're not going to lose corn and soy. Right. Those don't depend on bees for pollination and for reproduction. But the fruits, the vegetables, the nuts, all of these flowering, these foods that depend on the plants that flower, those are the ones that depend on bees in large parts and other pollinators. So we might see a drop off in, you know, we could potentially see, let's take New York again, the apple orchards, we could see less fruit set. So we could start out by seeing less apples being produced, which then creates all these sort of domino effects of economic burden and social burdens and all these other things. Worst case scenario, there's a province in China where their intensive agriculture essentially wiped out the bee population because of the insecticides they were using. It was so latent in the environment, they couldn't even import honeybee colonies. They would die out within a season because it was so bad. And they are hand pollinating all of their flowering fruit trees, which, if you want to talk about labor intensive, that's a lot of work, right?
I can only imagine.
So it's hard to say what a worst case scenario would be, but the fear would be is that we would lose certain fruits, vegetables, and nuts, which means we'd also be losing nutritional content, because just because you can fill up with calories from other types of food doesn't mean you're getting the same micronutrients. And then it's the question of, is if we need to keep those other things around, how would we end up replacing bees? And my answer would be, let's not lose them in the first place. Let's keep them around.
How does climate change interact with all of this, Matt? Is it impacting the bee population?
Again, that's something that people are looking at. And that goes back to that issue of how do we, you know, how much of a before picture do we have versus an after picture? What we can say, or what I think a lot of researchers would feel comfortable talking about, is climate change has the potentially impact bees, like it's going to impact us through extreme weather, through drought, all these other things. If you have a drought, if you have a really dry season, you're not going to have as many flowers. It's like shutting the grocery stores, right? I mean, bees aren't going to have access to their food sources. The other thing that's really interesting about climate change is how it throws seasons out of whack. it stays warmer longer. It doesn't quite as warm as soon enough. And you're seeing how that's in fact impacting plant varieties. What that has the potential to do to bees is that could cause some plants to flower sooner before the bees come out. And so they're out of sync. And so the flowers might still be there, but the bees haven't shown up yet. And by the time the bees get there, the flowers are gone. And then this this relationship that's evolved over thousands and thousands of years is suddenly broken. And that's where it could have the potential to really hurt bee populations.
So if we were to stick with the theme of let's not try to hurt bee populations.
Brilliant.
Toronto is a great example of working on a strategy, a pollinator protection strategy, it's called, to try to create that symbiotic relationship between humans and bees. Tell us a little bit about that. I know it's something that you were a big fan of.
Mm.
We had a pre-interview on the phone. We can't use those words on the air, but you were a super fan. That's all I can say.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on in Toronto.
So Toronto is doing a fantastic job with many things. And one of them is their pollinator protection plan, which first and foremost is focused on native pollinators, right? Very often, and again, I'm not trying to pick on honeybees, but very often when people say they want to save the bees, they think about setting up a beehive. And in many ways, that's like saying, I'm going to raise chickens to save the birds, right? Kind of.
Right.
So there are many other things we can be doing to save these variety of species. And what Toronto's done is has really focused on those native species. They focused on the native connections. And it's not just about planting more flowers. It's about creating this connectivity between where flowers are grown, how bees can get to where they nest, where they live, how do they overwinter, how do we create spaces on roofs, how do we change our mowing practices, how do we change the insecticides that we aren't using. And it's in large part about creating awareness because, again, one, you know, I think what we've certainly found in these conversations is that who knew there were 4,000 types of bees? Toronto can almost definitively say, they have 364 different species of bees living in the Toronto area, which is fantastic. It just by way of the fact that they know the variety of types, then you can start working forward and say, okay, I know these bees need this. I need these bees need this. I need these. No, these bees need this.
I'm looking at some of your work from the Bee Report, and green roofs seems that's Toronto. I think if I'm reading this correctly, Toronto was the first city in North America to require by law that all new commercial, institutional, and multifamily residential buildings of certain sizes have green roofs.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about green roofs.
Green roofs have some great potential because they can create pollinator habitat where it wouldn't otherwise have a place to be. Fun thing to think about that, though, is so many of these small solitary bees may not travel any more than 100 yards from where they live. Honeybees can go for 2 miles. Bumblebees can go for 2 miles. These little bees may only go for 100 yards. So if you think about where you're putting green roofs, if you put them too far up, it doesn't serve these other types of bees. But by knowing what types of bees you have, you know how to play these things out.
Do you think we're doing a good job locally understanding our bee populations in Rochester and the Finger Lakes? I know there's efforts by Greentopia to build a pollinator habitat. And, you know, how much do you know about what's going on at the local level? And are we doing a good job?
I think, well, one of the things I'm most excited about is the DEC and New York State are going to do a statewide survey of our bee populations, because that's one of the things that we need to have to understand how things might be changing and what we should be doing differently. And they're just kind of getting that off the ground right now. And that's pretty darn exciting. We know through a variety of research that New York State has roughly 465 different species of bees. There's even been studies done in New York City surveying bees down there. And fun fact, they actually found a brand new species in Central Park.
Oh.
That they didn't know existed and may just have only existed because it's Central Park. So these are the kind of things we need to figure out. By and large, I don't have an opinion on how we're doing locally. I cannot say. And that's one thing I think we're all still trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Great. Question from Tom via email. He says, did the Europeans who brought the honeybee over to America know that they were pollinators, or was it just dumb luck?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to. I would suspect they did, but I suspect they brought them over specifically for the honey. That was probably their primary motive.
Okay, great. Tom also says that I believe it was Lisa who called in earlier with the question about the big insect that she saw. Yeah, he's saying, I'm betting it was a horsefly. So still waiting on the picture from Lisa. We'll see if that comes in before the hour is up. But we also want to try to get some of your phone calls in our last few minutes with Matt Kelly, a farmer and writer who's an expert in bees. Up next on the phone is Pat in Brighton. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. I'm calling about honeybees. I'm a honeybee person. And so I have a kind of a multi-part question, but I just wanted to say that I'm also the founder of New York Bee Wellness, which is an educational 501c3, and we have a fight the mite program for beekeepers because the varroa mite parasite is really the biggest problem and the viruses it transmits. So that's our big focus. But we also do beekeeping surveys twice a year for New York State beekeepers, non-migratory. And last winter, we had about a 35% loss, which wasn't too bad. We've had worse years. But a lot of those colonies came out of winter really weak. And, in fact, we're playing catch-up, and we usually have bee swarms. And, in fact, the Rochester Beekeepers has a swarm catcher list if anyone gets any swarms. And we're just starting to get them. So we're really delayed because of the winter. And I'm wondering if you know of how the native bees have fared during this winter. Are they set back by the weather we had?
That's an excellent question. And I just want to say, I really appreciate you pointing out that if you have a swarm of bees, call someone who can collect them and bring them to a colony where they can be nurtured and facilitated. I think that's a great solution in many cases. The native bees, again, I can really only speak for what I've seen in my backyard. I've documented 8 different species in my backyard this year. As far as I can tell from my own personal N of one experience, they're doing pretty good. I've had no concerns out of my own personal experience, and I haven't heard of any concerns from researchers and other folks that I've talked to.
All right, so you're not seeing any delay at all in their emergence or anything like that?
Not to the best of my experience, no.
Okay, all right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Pat. Thanks for calling. Up next on the phone, Robert in Rochester. Go ahead, Robert. We got to keep it tight, though.
Just wanted to say really quick, I coach Little League baseball, and we have wooden dugouts, and my players are petrified of what looks like a huge bumblebee, but one of the players last weekend pointed out that he thought that it was a carpenter bee. So how do you distinguish between a carpenter bee and a bumblebee?
Yeah, so this is fun, and your kids will really dig this. You look for a shiny hiney. So bumblebees are basically furry all over. They can be almost exactly the same colors, like yellow up top, black down below on their abdomen, but bumblebees will be very furry down below. Carpenter bees they're naked on the butt, very shiny. And carpenter bees will also, if you get a chance to look at their face, have a very broad face, and they usually have this yellow patch right on the front of their face.
Aha.
Fun thing to share with your players there, Robert.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure.
You
got it.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. We're down to our last few minutes with Matt Kelly, and we have a couple questions coming in about mowing lawns. So how often should people be mowing their lawns in order to protect bees or encourage bee populations or maybe keep bees out of their yard if that's what they'd like to do? I know you've written about that on your website, but what's your best recommendation for lawn mowing?
So the best recommendation for people who have actually studied this in a suburban setting is mowing every 2 weeks. And the long and short of it is that allows enough time for the flowers that might serve smaller bee species to come up, but it also keeps the grass short enough where it doesn't get in the way of those flowers, because what the scientists originally thought is that, well, you just kind of let it go for 3 weeks and it's going to be awesome. But they actually saw a drop off in bees using those flowers after 3 weeks, and they think it's because the grass got too long. So if you keep it too short, flowers won't come up. Keep it too long, the small species can't get to the flowers.
So 2 weeks is the happy medium.
Yeah, that's what they found. And I guess I would say, to kind of put this in a more user-friendly context, it's, you need to keep your lawn looking like you need to keep it. But maybe you can raise the height on your mower. Maybe you can keep it right over the flowers and you can still trim it so it still looks nice and usable and is not an eyesore to all your neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about messy gardens?
Love them. I say love them. Yeah, messy. The messier the better. Brown is a color, and it has a place in the garden. So it's absolutely wonderful. Messy gardens serve as habitat. So very often when we think about bees, we think about giving them food. We don't think about giving them a place to live. And so for those, for the bees that will live in plant matter, in stems, and in burrows, a messy garden can give them a place to actually exist. Bare ground, just leaving a little patch of bare ground, can be brilliant for making space for bees in your yard.
Okay. I like something I read in the bee report. You said just like people, bees need easy access to housing and transportation.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going back to the Toronto situation, that is one of the essential things that they've thought about. Sure, we can plant flowers. Sure, we can create spaces for them to live. But again, thinking about these tiny bees that don't go more than 100 yards, how do they get from one place to the other? And that's that habitat fragmentation that has the potential to really disrupt bee populations.
Great. Matt Kelly, we can find you at The Bee Report. What's the URL for people who are interested in learning more?
TheBeeReport.com.
TheBeeReport.com. Are you, and you're on Twitter as well. How can we find you on Twitter?
Actually, I'm not on Twitter. I'm on Facebook.
Oh, okay. You're not on Twitter.
Don't judge me.
I've been tweeting to the wrong person then. My fault for that. Matt Kelly, a farmer and a writer, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise on bees. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Hanging out here in WEOS today in Geneva. Our thanks to Greg and Kelly, our colleagues here, always doing a great job. My thanks to our engineer, John Andrus. Thank you, John. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson. Hey, listeners, have a great weekend. It is beautiful outside. Get out there, hang out with the bees, and we will talk to you Monday.